idea. Gasoline prices get high enough, people get interested in biofuels. Key ingredient? Restaurant grease, fryer grease. Motive meets opportunity. Bingo! Grease theft. Disgusting, isn't it?
Yep, disgusting, but lucrative. And it looks like Governor Brown is about to sign a new law that'll increase penalties for stealing used cooking oil. Later in the show, we'll take a closer look at that disgusting business of grease rustling. But first, abortion providers in Texas are waiting for a ruling today that might put them out of business. A federal appeals court is deciding whether to let a Texas state law go into effect. It had been found unconstitutional by a lower court. If the court rules in favor of the state of Texas, all but seven of the state's clinics will have to shut down immediately. Brian Rosenthal is a reporter covering Texas state government in Austin for the Houston Chronicle. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, I understand there were arguments today at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. What happened?
Well, the state was presenting its case at the appeals court, asking the court to allow enforcement of the law as this legal fight continues. So as you mentioned, the local judge had declared the law unconstitutional, and that is being appealed, and that fight is going to continue. But in the meantime, the state wants to be able to go ahead and enforce the law.
Right. And so do we expect a decision today on that?
It's unclear. A decision could come down today. It could come down next week. It could even come down after that. It's just unclear. The judges haven't offered any indication of what they'll do.
Okay. Now let's get some background, because the lower court decided that two provisions of this law were unconstitutional. One was that clinics had to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, and the other is that they needed to be ambulatory surgical centers. What does that mean?
Well, the ambulatory surgical center language is a type of facility in Texas and in other states in which major surgical procedures are done. Typically an abortion would not be considered one of those procedures. And so the standards for how the facility has to have the type of equipment they have to have, the length of the hallways and the ability to get a stretcher through is all determined and meant for facilities that do a very serious procedures. But what this law did is said that abortion facilities, which have typically not had to comply with those standards because they do procedures that are less intense, will have to in the future.
So I understand that since this law was passed a year ago, half of the state's 40 or so centers that provided abortions had to close?
That's right. There were 41 clinics in operation before the law, although some of those closed, not necessarily due to the law, maybe due to the bad publicity of the law. But immediately after the law took effect, many clinics closed, especially because of the provision having to do with admitting privileges, doctors just have not been able to obtain those admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. So we're down to about 20 out of the 41 in operation beforehand. And if this ambulatory surgical center requirement takes effect, the abortion facilities are not going to be able to comply. So we're going to see more closures, and it's expected that only about seven will be open.
Only about seven. And I don't know, can you talk a little bit about the problems with admitting privileges? Because the proponents of the law are saying, well, that's necessary for the woman's health, that if something goes wrong during the procedure, the doctor needs to be able to admit that patient to a nearby hospital.
Right. That is the argument from the state. The argument from providers is that you can get somebody to a hospital and get them the help they need without the doctor that performed the procedure having admitted privileges. The doctor could, call and communicate with the doctors at the hospital. And furthermore, they argue that complications in abortion is extremely rare. And they have had a lot of trouble getting the privileges. Doctors at different clinics have had, and the providers say that refusals to give privileges is not due to any problem with the doctors. It's due, again, to PR, that hospitals don't want to be seen giving admitting privileges to people to allow them to bring patients in to doctors that perform abortions.
Now, the proponents of the law are saying this is not an anti-abortion law. This is a woman's health law, and that if they are anti-abortion, that this is just a happy coincidence for them that this is having an effect on the availability of abortions.
That's right, and that's one of the central arguments of the case. One of the things that the local judge found is he actually ruled that because he felt the admitting privileges and the ambulatory surgical centers would do nothing to improve women's health, he found that the purpose of the law was only to close down clinics, and that was in large part the reason for his decision. The state, of course, is arguing that they were trying to protect the safety of women in Texas, and if they're able to make that argument successfully, they're likely to win on appeal.
So how is this playing out in Texas itself? I mean, there was that very dramatic and nationally recognized story of Wendy Davis, the Democratic legislator, and her 11-hour filibuster effort. And there's been a lot of national news coverage of this. What's happening in the state in terms of support or non-support of this law?
Well, it's kind of the same that we have seen for a long time. We had the big filibuster last year, and it really energized abortion rights supporters as well as anti-abortion activists. And since then, a lot has happened. This is the second lawsuit over the case. We've gone up to the Supreme Court and back, and now heading that way again. And I think the biggest impact of all that on the advocates in the state is a hardening of battle lines. People seem to, and I guess this is the case with abortion no matter where you are, but people have their view on abortion and on the law, and opportunity we have, every hearing seems to be an excuse to have that argument once again. So I'm not sure the state is over the argument that it had last summer.
Yeah, well, and how's it playing into the immigration debate, if it is? I mean, South Texas in particular is Democratic, but also Catholic. A lot of immigrants from Mexico and Central America.
Right, that's true, and a lot even liberal Democrats in South Texas strongly oppose abortion. Actually, one of the strongest anti-abortion advocates in the legislature is a Democrat from South Texas. It's definitely an issue down there. South Texas is especially important in this case because the providers have noted that now there is no abortion clinic in South Texas as a result of this law, and that's one of the things that they're trying to get that one reopened. So it's certainly, the stakes are certainly higher in South Texas.
Brian Rosenthal covers state government in Austin for the Houston Chronicle. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, grease is the word. It's also the money. Kitchen grease from restaurants is big business, so that means it's a big opportunity for theft. How multinationals are trying to squeeze out independent grease rustlers, next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Several bills are sitting on Governor Brown's desk waiting for his signature. AB 1156 is the slimiest of them all, and no, it's not what you think. The bill would increase penalties for stealing used cooking oil, and it beefs up law enforcement's efforts to stop modern-day grease rustlers. Yeah, if you can believe it, used cooking oil is very, very valuable, and stealing it has become a lucrative crime. John Colapinto is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he wrote the article called Hot Grease, the Wild West of Used Cooking Oil Theft for the magazine last year. He joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
Tell us what they used to do with this cooking oil before biofuel came along.
It's the used grease that actually places like McDonald's put into bins outside in the back alley after they've done all the cooking of the French fries. And this stuff used to be sprayed on to feed that you would then give to pigs and cows in order to fatten them up quicker. Yeah, it's kind of gross. It was an efficient way, though, to fatten up the animals. But then, you know, it increased in value a huge amount in recent years because people started to realize that you could molecularly fool around with it and turn it into a biofuel that's capable of fueling jet airliners. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
So what is it used for? It's used for airliners. What else?
Yeah, people, I guess, you know, can use it for their cars. I mean, that's a less sophisticated process in order to make it capable to use for your car. The making of biofuels that are sufficient for fueling jet aircraft, that's an expensive process that you really need big corporations to get involved in. And that is actually something that's been happening in the last couple of years with one corporation that I wrote about in my story called Darling or DARPRO, really being the kind of leading edge on that, actually partnering with a gas company called Valero and building a huge plant in order to convert this stuff into biofuel.
And so this big, huge company, DARPRO, they go around taking individual restaurants' used cooking oil?
They do. It's amazing. And they collect about 2 billion pounds of it a year. I mean, they make millions on it. And, you know, it's something that's gone on, you know, for many years. But, you know, it's now become something that is truly lucrative. And you've got these companies like DARPRO, there's a couple of others, kind of protecting that stuff now and really wanting it.
Okay, and so then there are all these little guys that you also write about in your article, and I guess this law that the governor here in California is about to sign would crack down on them. They're the ones, or some of them at least, are accused of taking this oil when the big companies say it's their oil.
Yes, it's a heck of a fight. My story, I kind of dug down deep into how the whole used cooking grease economy began many decades ago, where it was a free-for-all. Restaurants just wanted to get rid of this disgusting, stinky stuff. They would put it into unmarked barrels at the back of the restaurant alleyway, and it was anyone that wanted to pick it up, they were free to take it. It was for free. No money changed hands. And, you know, people would come, and a lot of them immigrant workers that didn't have a lot of education or money. But it was free money sitting in these back alleyways. Not much money because the stuff was worth a penny or so, you know, a pound. But they would come, they would collect it, they would sell it to farms, and everyone was happy. What happened when one of these bigger food corporations, rendering outfits they're actually called, that actually do things like render grease from old animal parts that were discarded from farms, they were basically in the business, these companies, of collecting calories wherever they could get them. And what they started to do was they realized, hey, you know, there's some real money in this stuff, and no more should there just be unmarked barrels. Let's make a contract with these restaurants, and we'll, you know, we'll pay them a little bit of money for their grease, or at least we'll promise to, and we'll put a big box out back that says Griffin Industries on it. And, you know, now if anyone breaks into that box or takes grease out of it, you know, that's a criminal act, or we'll try to convince, you know, the powers that be that that's a criminal act. And, you know, they've had a lot of trouble over the years convincing anyone, A, to take it seriously, B, to think of it as a criminal act. But in California, it looks like they've got some traction on that now.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us how these little guys, these rustlers, steal the oil in the first place.
Well, actually, it sort of depends on how small a rustler we're talking about. You or I, and if things get bad for either of us, Madeline, we could go into this together. We could drive around in like a pickup truck with some barrels, and we could break into one of these boxes, and then we could like ladle the stuff out. Now, we would get very greasy and we'd stink pretty bad, but we could ladle it into like a larger container. Or if we wanted to kind of scale up, we would do what the more serious grease rustler does now. Break into the container, I guess I'd have to say, because very often they're locked now. And we would stick this big hose in there and we would just suck out that grease. And we could get like a big container that's about 4 feet high. We could empty that thing in just a few minutes. You and I could drive down an alleyway behind a strip mall series of restaurants, and in maybe 2 hours, we could make about, I don't know, $5,000-$6,000 worth of grease. So if we drove around all night, we could do pretty well.
Yeah. Tell us how they value the cooking oil, because some of it, I understand, is more valuable than others.
Yes. I really, you know, all of it, once it's cleaned, is of the same value. But when you go out to rustle grease, if you go to a barbecue place where there's a lot of shredded meat that's going to be in that thrown out grease, and there'll also be a lot of water because the restaurateurs throw frozen meat into their fryers. So when you extract that grease with your suction hose and you have it in your tank, it's not very good grease. Now, there's places like chicken shops are apparently the best ones to go and get grease from. One of the big chains that they love to collect from there, because the grease tends to be extremely clean, very little water in it. And so what happens is you take it to the renderer, and the renderer decides how much to pay you by pouring a little sample of the grease into a test tube, putting it into a centrifuge, spinning it really quickly to make the sediment go to the bottom, and then looking at how pure that grease is. And if you've got grease that's, you know, you've got very, very little sediment or waste in it, then you can get top dollar for it.
So what's it worth usually around?
Boy, you know, it was fluctuating like crazy. The guys that I looked at were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. The grease rustlers that I spoke with, one of the guys had a fleet of antique cars, including a Bentley that he had just bought for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, it's amazing.
Okay, I'm quitting my job. I'm doing it. Sounds good. Done.
Yeah, I thought I could hook you into this.
Well, since it sounds so lucrative and so easy to do the way you describe it, why aren't more people doing it? Or are a lot of people doing it?
You know, it really is. It's nasty work. It's night work. You're doing it at night because, the grease rustlers would claim they do it at night because the restaurants don't want a big grease truck parked out during the day because it's unappetizing. The big corporations would say that these guys are thieves and they're doing it at night because no one's looking. It's all a shadow world. Again, very slippery. But, there's actually a surprising number of people actually doing it. I mean, you do have to buy the truck. You've got to buy the vacuum hose. One of the guys that I rode around with all night told me that back in the day he had something like 7,000 accounts, meaning there was this many restaurants that he would go to and collect grease. Now, he wouldn't hit them all, but he knew of them. He had verbal agreements with them, so he claims. He was down to like a handful by the time I met him and went out. And the reason why is because there was now so much competition. I don't have hard figures for you, but I mean, in this dreadful economy that we still seem to be mired in, a tremendous number of people are actually taking this up. Also environmentalists. I mean, people, it's not just kind of the kind of wacky crew of fly-by-night grease wrestlers that I wrote about in my piece. There's also sort of concerted environmentalist types. I interviewed one of them, you know, who are really getting into it for all the, quote, right reasons of wanting to create biofuels that make our environment less dirty.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Colapinto. He's a New Yorker writer, and he's written a story about grease rustlers. The governor here in California is about to sign AB 1156, which would increase the penalties for stealing used cooking oil. So these little guys, they're also selling it to airlines, or where are they selling their grease?
Good question. What they're doing is they're selling it to renderers, small independent renderers, renderers being the people that actually will go through the process of cleaning that grease of the chicken wings and shrimp and so on, and making it clean enough to then sell it up the line to a fancier outfit, very often a fuel company. So these rustlers, again, they have to sell it to an independent renderer. And part of what's been going on with these big corporations like DARPRO and Griffin, which have now merged, is that they are trying to shut down the renderers. They're saying, we don't want those rustlers to have anywhere that they can sell the grease. And if they can shut down the renderers, that means they've shut down all competition, because the only other people that are rendering the stuff are those huge corporations like DARPRO. So they have been systematically shutting down the little renderer. And it's a pretty convenient way to make sure that you really have no competition for the grease.
So where are they now? What's happening? Are all these small renderers being slowly shut out of business? Is that what's happening? And there's this consolidation?
Yeah, there have been a number that have shut down, but there are always, you know, this being America, there's always tough, you know, gritty people that refuse to back down in the face of the big powers that are threatening them. And so when I was in Houston last year, there was a very, very sort of, if I can use the word on NPR, ballsy outfit, an independent renderer. That refused to be intimidated and that was staying open. And the particular chap that I wrote about, a guy named Everett Henley and his sons that run their own small grease collection company, that's where they were selling their grease, was to this sort of smaller independent renderer. Now, that doesn't mean that renderer isn't being surveyed, because they are. There are literally cars with, you know, darkened windows watching people go in and out of there, taking license plates. They've actually had, I mean, they use the word threats by the big renderers that actually have come by and said, you know, who are you buying from? I need to see. And, you know, so there is this strong arming going on. And a lot of people will wilt in the face of this. Again, there is money to be made. There's kind of big money to be made. And very often these independent renderers will just duke it out until the moment where they're either shut down or arrested or whatever it is that happens to shut them down. I actually wrote about a guy who 20 years ago was running a small rendering operation in Houston, and they crushed him. I mean, they crushed him under.
I had no idea that this was such a vicious business, the grease business.
Yeah, it's fascinatingly vicious, and I was thinking about it on the way over here. Why is it so vicious? And really, it's because, I guess, anytime there's free money sitting out back in dark alleyways, you know, you get people scrambling for it. You know, you get some elements that are a little less savory than others. But sometimes, and I say this with all due, you know, sort of innocence. I mean, sometimes it's even big, shiny corporations that are listed on the stock exchange. I mean, I know it's shocking for all of us to hear, but sometimes even those entities that look ever so clean and spanking, and the executives wear ties and so on, sometimes they can sometimes play a little nasty themselves.
That's shocking to me. I don't know what you're talking about.
I know. The scales have fallen from your eyes, Madeline, on this, but there it is.
Yeah. Well, I guess oil, no matter where it comes from, is big business. And
that's it. As the guy from DARPRO said to me, the CEO, a wonderful guy, I mean, just a big American guy, Randy Stewie, said to me, you know, everything's a calorie, and we all want to get after those calories. Calories are very, very important. They run the world. That and dollars.
John Colapinto is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his article is called Hot Grease, the Wild West of Used Cooking Oil Theft. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, speaking of movies, coming up, it's movie time. We're going to check out this week's big releases. They included James Gandolfini, Tom Hardy thriller, and the funny, sad story of a pair of twins, played by Saturday Night Live stars Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader. Reviews after this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Tom Hardy with a Brooklyn accent, a dolphin with teenage handlers and a prosthetic tail, two stars from Saturday Night Live as twins, and Idris Elba as a serial killer. That's what's new in theaters this weekend. Matt Atchedy is editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Hi there.
Hello.
And Scott Mance is the film critic for Access Hollywood. Hello.
Hello.
Okay, well, let's start with, I guess this is an organized crime movie. It's called The Drop, which stars James Gandolfini and Tom Hardy.
That bar stool that you put that old biddy at and bought her free drinks, and don't think I don't know that you did it on purpose. That was my stool, and nobody sat on that stool because it was Cousin Marv's stool, and that meant something. That meant something.
But it didn't. Ever. It was just a stool.
So James Gandolfini, you can't mistake that voice.
Can't mistake that voice.
This is his last film?
His last film, and he goes out on a very high note. Of course, James Gandolfini in an organized crime movie, can't go wrong. I mean, Sopranos, I mean, it's the kind of tough guy role in which he really made his name and he excels so well. I like The Drop a lot. It's a really good screenplay, a lot more humor than I expected for a movie like this, and it has a great payoff.
It's a Dennis Lehane screenplay.
Yes,
right?
It is a Dennis Lehane screenplay. Ironically, not in Boston, like most of his books are, because this is the gentleman who gave us Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone. This is based off what started out as a book idea for him and didn't get past one or two chapters, and it kind of stalled out, but then he converted it into a screenplay. I liked this one a lot.
What's the basic plot?
The basic plot is, sadly, with a title like The Drop, it's not about dubstep. That's kind of what I hope. This is about a drop bar where local mobsters will do their payoffs kind of out of sight of the cops and whoever's watching them. They'll drop off envelopes of money, and then somebody else comes and picks them up, and it kind of functions almost as a bank for the local mob. Now, the movie is set in this bar that used to be owned by Marv, James Gandolfini's character, but he got bought out. Tom Hardy is his cousin who works in the bar, and it's this slow burn of a movie that pays off so well. I really liked this movie.
Yeah, it is definitely a slow burn. You get into the characters. There's more romance than you'd expect from a movie like this. There's a lot more humor in a movie like this than you'd expect. People were laughing throughout the film, but this is crucial. The humor does not infringe on the suspense, on the intensity. They complement each other versus intrude on each other.
You know, you see scenes in their house, and that's a very lived-in Brooklyn house with things all the attention to detail, and the world that they live in is very realized. And so you really get a sense of the grumbling, for instance, that Marv does about where he used to be, where he is now, because it's grounded in that kind of day-to-day, small-time, has-been world. He earns that emotion. You earn the feeling of what he's missing from where he used to be. And I think it really works.
Okay, let's go in the opposite direction now. A heartwarming family movie called Dolphin Tale 2. It takes place at an aquatic mammal park in Florida.
No sign of infection, so we discontinued antibiotics. White cell count is normal. And her sunburn is totally healed. That is pretty much a clean bill of health.
Yeah. That's fantastic. So, can we talk about pairing her with Winter? Because after Winter's
having... Hazel, what I'm saying is that Mandy's fine. And we have an obligation.
You can't release her. We're going to pair her with
Winter. How can I not release her?
Because all you have to do is wait 6 months or a year so we can
find
another female.
10 years. We don't know what's going to happen, Hazel. If Mandy can't go home, then she deserves to go home.
This is a sequel. This is based on the story of a dolphin named Winter who had lost her tail and was given a prosthetic tail. This takes place at a rehab center for animals that have been injured, and the whole focus of this hospital is to rehab the animals and get them back out into the wild. Winter is an unusual case in that she cannot survive on her own. But the tension of the movie is that a group called the USDA, which is the Dolphin Association, not the Dairy Association, tells them that there are strict rules that say a dolphin cannot be kept by itself. So the Clearwater group stands to lose Winter because the dolphin she's paired up with dies early in the film of old age. And so that's what conflict there is in the movie. There's not a lot.
Who is it for?
It's not for little kids. I will say that. I would say
are
that
there
if you're,
some scenes of dolphin
well,
violence?
No, a little bit. You know, there's the scene early on where one of the dolphins dies of old age, but it's a very tame, very safe movie. And that kind of has somewhat of a detraction on the story. You don't really get that invested in the drama of it. You know,
it's no Flipper.
It's no Flipper. You know, and if I'm damning with faint praise, then it's okay. It's not
for
that.
A sequel. It's, you know, okay.
All right, time to move on then, because I think we can move on to Skeleton Twins, The Skeleton Twins, starring Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Have you read Marley and Me?
Yeah. Sad.
Why is it sad?
You don't know what happens?
No, that's why I'm reading it.
What, does the dog die at the end?
No, I'm not saying anything.
Look how much I had left.
I was thinking you'd come stay with me.
Is it okay if I tell him? We're trying to get pregnant.
That's great.
And yep. You say we are because it's not sexist that way, right? That's what you told me.
Yeah.
I can't wait to be the creepy gay uncle.
You're hired.
Okay, so this is actually about a brother and a sister, right, Scott? I mean, it's not what the trailer implied there.
Right. Definitely not what the trailer implied. Now, this goes back to Sundance. This movie won the screenwriting award at Sundance, and for good reason. This is a smart, sharp, articulate, moving screenplay. It's about two dysfunctional, suicidal brother and sister siblings, twins, hence the Skeleton Twins. Very typical for the kind of movie you would see at Sundance, because it's deep. There's a lot of angst in the movie. But boy, was this a surprise, because it's a feel-good movie.
Even though it starts with an attempted suicide?
And even though it starts with basically two attempted suicides, because Kristen Wiig's character is about to kill herself, but then she gets word that her brother actually tried it, so she has to go to the hospital. And that's where the two of them, they've been estranged, so they come back together to work through their issues, and they bond, and they rediscover their love for each other as brother and sister. But this is a feel-good movie. It's the dysfunctional, feel-good, suicidal sibling movie of the year. And the two of them, I have to say, Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader, you know, they're veterans from SNL, so they have a rapport, they have chemistry, they know each other's rhythm, but their chemistry in this movie is fantastic. They are both superb with more serious performances, but Bill Hader, wow, what a revelation.
Really?
He's fantastic.
So I saw a little bit more of the trailer, and it looked like in one scene that they were improvising.
Oh, yeah.
And do you think there was some of that?
No question about it. In fact, when I interviewed them at Sundance, they said that a lot of what they went through, even though it was very, very scripted, they went off script a little bit. That's what they do. They're both improv masters. I mean, look at SNL. They were on their show for years.
Yeah.
And that improv lends the film an air of honesty, an air of intimacy that makes it very, very endearing.
I like that we brought up the improv, though, because, you know, a lot of people think improv means that the cameras are rolling and they're just kind of messing around. And I think that the actual process is closer to when your actors, when Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader are rehearsing, they're exploring their characters, and they're almost kind of making their own pass at the script while in character. And that works as much with drama as it does with comedy. So I think that, to your point, the improv skills that they've, you know, nailed down on SNL absolutely will help them in dramatic roles.
And it's like jazz. It's like jazz. You just have to go for the feel of the rhythm. And they know how to do that. There is one scene in this movie that brought a smile to the face of everybody in the theater where they're singing "Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now." It is such a wonderful moment in the film, and it's the moment of the film that everybody's been talking about.
Okay, last but not least, it's a movie. Maybe it is least. It's called No Good Deed, and it stars Idris Elba.
I won't do anything. I promise. Please put him down.
Just be smart.
License and registration, please. Your baby needs to be in a car seat.
Oh, he was. He was. But we took him out just as we stopped. He was crying.
Mommy, where is Daddy? I want to go home.
Ma'am, could you step out of the car, please?
Okay, so Idris Elba plays a serial killer. Is he reprising Stringer Bell here?
Maybe.
We don't know.
We don't know. Exactly.
Because they pulled the screeners, right?
Yeah, they canceled the screening. You know, everybody knows that movies sometimes don't get screened for critics, right?
Which is a big sign.
And that's never a good sign.
Never a good sign.
Right, the conventional wisdom, nobody hides a good movie.
Whenever a studio decides to not hold screenings, it's usually a bad sign, because you're basically announcing this movie is not good enough to screen for critics. But that's okay. There are a lot of movies that don't do well with critics that do very well with the masses. Look at the Transformers movies. But with a movie like this, where it's not a big summer tentpole action superhero superhero movie, where it's more of a drama, more of a thriller. Not screening it for critics is like saying, hey, yeah, this is a turkey.
However, there is another theory out there that because this involves domestic violence and killing of women by a black man, that given the Ray Rice news this week, that's why they pulled it.
That could be part of it.
Although, sure,
they're still releasing it. I mean, it's not like they're not releasing it.
Yeah, they're
the
not
movie.
Pulling it from theaters, so they're not saying, okay, we're making a statement here about the recent news, so we're going to hold it back and release it another time or just put it on video on demand or home video. It's still coming out today.
Yeah, the word from the studio was that they were pulling the screenings because they were worried about a twist that would get spoiled. Which,
Not buying it.
Yeah, no, I think that's publicity speak.
All right, so Scott, you just got back from Toronto.
Yes.
And what's the headline?
Well, the headline is overall, Toronto this year wasn't as strong as last year. Last year you had Gravity, 12 Years a Slave, Dallas Buyers Club. Those were big movies that went the distance for the next 6 months till the Oscars. Still good movies to be found. The one that everyone was really talking about, myself included, was Foxcatcher. This is with Steve Carell, Channing Tatum. Holy moly, wait till you see Steve Carell in this movie, wearing a prosthetic nose, gained all this weight, wearing fake teeth as John DuPont, the sponsor of the Olympic wrestler, played by Channing Tatum, who was also very good. Steve Carell will, I'm saying this now, he will get nominated. He is fantastic. Another movie I loved was Wild, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who directed Dallas Buyers Club. That movie led to a Best Actor win for Matthew McConaughey. Reese Witherspoon will get nominated for this. She plays an emotionally fragile woman who goes on a 1,000-mile trek along the Pacific Crest Trail. Physically and emotionally grueling performance. The movie I loved was Whiplash. I saw it at Sundance. I saw it again in Toronto. Wow, this movie will give you whiplash. It is wild. It is intense. It is unpredictable with a great payoff. Miles Teller plays an aspiring jazz drummer, and it's a battle of wits between him and his music instructor, played by J.K. Simmons. Fantastic movie. And finally, Men, Women, and Children, from director Jason Reitman, son, Jason. Mm-hmm. Just like 2009's Up in the Air was very right now because of the recession, Men, Women, and Children, the most provocative film at the Toronto Film Festival, feels very right now because of our addiction to the internet, to cell phones, to texting. It is a hot button movie. I had a friend who saw it. He said it made him angry.
What's it about?
It's an ensemble with Adam Sandler in a serious role, Jennifer Garner, and Ansel Elgort, who was just in Fault in Our Stars. And it's an ensemble about all these people, all these families, and how the internet and how the information overload and how we're always on our cell phones texting, how it's desensitized us, how it has made us less intimate with our friends and loved ones. It is a call to action. It holds a mirror up to our society because as great as the internet is with getting like airline tickets and t-shirts and getting movie tickets, it is also overload. And how, you know, there's a scene in the movie where people are walking down the street and they're all on their cell phones and they're all texting. And as I was walking from the screening to do interviews for the film, I was walking down Yonge Street and Bay Street in Toronto, and I'm looking around and everybody's on their cell phones. They're all texting. And I'm like, well, what do you know? This movie was right on the money.
So it's like Her, but from the negative point of view. You're not going to fall in love.
You're not going to fall in love with your cell phone in this movie. No way.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I'm also hearing a lot of buzz around Top 5, which is
Chris Rock's
movie.
Yeah, that got picked up by Paramount.
Yeah, for a huge amount of money.
Yeah, that's
like
a good sign.
Something, what, like $15 million or something like
and
that?
What
yeah.
is that?
That's his movie.
He's directed it. Third movie as a director.
Yeah, and it looks very exciting. I haven't seen it yet because I wasn't at Toronto, but I've heard some people say that this is his Annie Hall.
Yeah, that's right. That's what
Chris
they were saying.
Chris Rock's Annie Hall?
Chris Rock's Annie Hall.
Well, that's good because there were no black people in Annie Hall. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Scott Mance, film critic for Access Hollywood, and Matt Achety, editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Well, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome Tess Vigeland into the studio.
Oh, it's entirely my pleasure, Molly.
No, mine. It's mine.
Should we go on?
This is what happens when two women are in the same studio. Filling in for Warren Olney and to tell us what's coming up at 1 o'clock on TV.
Yeah, we've got a really packed show today. First of all, as I'm sure you're aware, the Ebola virus is just spreading like wildfire. And the WHO came out this morning and said, basically, if we don't get more help, if we don't get more doctors on the ground, we're going to have a really, really big problem. So we're going to talk about that with someone who was reporting from Geneva today. And the bulk of the program We're going to address misogyny in the NFL and in pro sports in general, obviously coming out of the Ray Rice case. Where does the NFL go now? What happens to Roger Goodell? He's certainly not the only one. This is a major problem, so we'll have a big discussion on that.
All right. That sounds fantastic. Looking forward to that at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Tess Viglin, filling in for Warren Olney. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And coming up on this show, why LA's West Siders' affluent parents are not vaccinating their children. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Politics, religion, money. Now you can add another topic to the list of things to avoid in polite conversation. Vaccinations. The number of people choosing not to vaccinate their children continues to rise, especially in the tonier communities of West Los Angeles, where many affluent families subscribe to a, let's say, nonconformist view of immunization. But the trend has health experts worried, especially as cases of whooping cough and measles climb throughout California. Gary Baum is senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. He's been looking into this trend of non-vaccination among the Hollywood and West Side elite. Hi, Gary.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You looked at the rate of people choosing not to vaccinate their kids by examining school records and specifically what's known as a personal belief exemption. First, tell us what that is and what you found.
What that is it's a form that parents have to file at the beginning of each school year if they are not going to fully immunize their kids, if they haven't done that. Basically, it's in lieu of filing all proper paperwork showing that their kids are fully immunized. And what we found by studying state numbers throughout LA County is that the West Side has a startlingly higher number of PBEs, and that comes down into DTaP, which is for whooping cough and for a couple of other things, as well as for MMR, which is for measles and a couple of other things there. It really shows that this issue is far more prominent in wealthier communities than in those that are not.
Can you give us an example of the rates of some schools of these personal belief exemptions?
Yeah, I mean, some of these schools are really surprisingly high, and some of them are very prominent. You have schools like the Waldorf Early Childhood Center in Santa Monica at 68%, the Cabala Children's Academy in Beverly Hills at 57%. These are really surprising numbers, and they cross the West Side. And by the West Side, I'm using the County Department of Public Health definition, which is basically La Cienega West and Malibu down to Marina Del Rey.
And by comparison, the LA County average is what, around 2%?
It's about 2%.
Okay. And so is there definitely a correlation between personal belief exemptions and then the increases in domestic measles cases, now at a 20-year high, and whooping cough cases?
That's what public health authorities have told me. Here in California, we're in the midst of a pertussis outbreak, which is whooping cough, right now.
And this is particularly dangerous for infants, right? Because they can't get inoculated as soon as they're born. They have to wait to get the vaccination. So there's a period, if their parents do want to give them the vaccination, where they are prone to getting this disease from an older kid.
Correct. Oftentimes they're playmates or their older siblings.
What is driving this distrust of vaccinations? Were you able to figure that out?
You know, it's a mixture of things. It's a contrarianism. It's a certain general distrust for the medical establishment. And it's also a general privilege. It's a belief that one knows as much or perhaps more than one's doctor, and generally medical authorities at large. There's a confidence on the West Side that one is able to kind of just engage with one's doctor or find another doctor to confirm one's belief.
If most children are vaccinated and there's just this minority that is not vaccinated, how in danger is the rest of society if most people are vaccinated?
The way that vaccination works is that sometimes vaccines don't take. Some children can't be vaccinated. Some people are too young to be vaccinated. Some people, there are various reasons why vaccines require the social contract, the social obligation of vaccinating as a group. That's part of what we do as a community. That's what we do as a society. And that's the way that vaccines work. It's not done just individually. It's what we do collectively.
And there is a threshold, right? There is a herd immunity threshold. What is that?
Yes. It's, you know, it shifts depending on what the disease is. For a couple of these common childhood diseases, for instance, like measles and pertussis, whooping cough, it begins, according to the CDC, it begins to be breached at as little as 6 to 8%.
6 to 8%. And then, as you were saying earlier, you've got personal belief exemptions in some of these schools at what, 68%, 57%?
Yes, yes. You know, very quickly it moves up 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60%.
So I know these parents are well-meaning and they want to do the best things. I mean, these are parents, as you describe in your story, who are interested in doing things naturally and eating well and having organic food and concerned with the community and all that kind of thing. But what do they say to you when you ask them why they don't vaccinate their kids when it comes to the larger society?
You know, they just don't really buy into the seriousness of the idea of breaking herd immunity. They understand in theory that this could be an issue, but they believe that their child comes first. They're far more concerned about what might come of their child, uneases that they feel about their children, potential fears over everything from eczema to allergies, and they want to do right by their child as they see it before what they see as a theoretical noble good for the society at large.
And there's also a well-placed fear, I guess, of pharmaceutical companies. There have been many, many stories about pharmaceutical companies marketing drugs that turned out to be bad for us. And so I think that with a little or maybe a lot of information that these parents have, they have a well-nourished fear of big pharma and of the medical establishment.
Yeah, you know, there's a concern over the profit motive. And there's also a larger look at sort of the sweep of medical history. They feel as though they might be at the vanguard of a certain way of thinking and that medical consensus changes and that the arc of history is long and that they don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
So what are the schools saying to you? Are they concerned about this?
We attempted to reach out to several dozen schools. Only a minority chose to respond. A very few of them registered outright unease. Most of them tried to mitigate the issue for various reasons, bringing up everything from the fact that many people are partially vaccinated to the fact that sometimes parents are signing the form because it's easier to sign the form than to show proof of vaccination or because their school starts slightly earlier in the season. Various reasons to, and in certain ways, dissemble on the issue. But there was what was more important is that there were very few schools that showed serious concern about these high numbers. And a lot of it comes out of the fact that these are, for the most part, private schools, and they are competing for tuition dollars from parents who, just as they can doctor shop, can school shop, and they are very much willing to speak their mind and to push back if how they feel their right is not respected. And so there's a lot of genuflecting to parents.
So this is mainly happening in private schools, that public schools, they have a different set of criteria when it comes to vaccinating?
No, the criteria is the same. However, because it's an issue of privilege, if you look at the way that it works out, particularly if you invite listeners to visit our interactive map online, you can really just see the way that this works out across the region. You look at schools in working class neighborhoods, in lower class neighborhoods, and these PBE percentages are pretty much nil. People follow the rules, so to speak, in working class communities from Pacoima to Pico Rivera to Compton. This is not an issue at all. People are just happy to go to the doctor and listen and do what they're told. You get these really startling percentages in the wealthiest communities.
Is there a risk at all to kids who are vaccinated and to adults?
It's less of a risk to adults for some of these diseases because their immune systems are stronger. Those that are elderly can sometimes be at more risk. Yes, there is a risk to children that are vaccinated because sometimes vaccines do not take.
And you don't know if you're at risk until you get the disease.
Correct.
Well, Gary Baum, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Gary Baum is senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. You can check out his article on why some of LA's wealthy parents are choosing not to vaccinate at our website, kcrw.com. Julie Myers is here with the feedback, and I'm guessing lots of response to that story.
Of course, our listeners wanted to weigh in on vaccinating. They always do, and we thank them for it. On Facebook, Jim Shee says that neither your wallet size, nor your fame, nor your ego entitles you to escape the boundaries of currently accepted treatment guidelines for all children. And I could almost hear Greg Swartz sigh while he typed, "This makes me want to move." Susan Land says, "You want my thoughts? I think anti-vaxxers are an idiotic danger to society." And Angel Partida was incredulous. He says, "In this day and age, tisk tisk Hollywood. Let's hope that polio remains eradicated." But Lisa Mancini went against the grain of our Facebook listeners today. She says she has mixed feelings about vaccines. They're making vaccines for everything nowadays. Normal childhood sicknesses like the flu and chicken pox. She feels like it's just too many. She has 5 children, and every time they're vaccinated, she says she gets a sick feeling in her gut. Lisa says she believes that over-vaccination is to blame for autism, to which 10Cat responds on the Facebook thread, "You can believe it all you want, won't make it true."
All right, this is a debate I guess we will not resolve right here or on our Facebook page, but you are welcome to weigh in at KCRW Press Play. That's our Facebook page, our Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Mine is at The Mad Brand. Julie Myers, have a great weekend.
You too.
And you too, all you great press players out there, to the point with Tess Viglin. I was about to say Warren Olney. Tess Viglin, guest hosting, is up next. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.